Whakalofala I atu, you're listening to Tangata o te Moana from RNZ Pacific, ko Koroi Hawkins e hingo haku. First up,
almost two-thirds of households have either lost jobs or lost income.
Experts are warning the pandemic could undo a decade's worth of development gains in the Pacific.
I'm totally ecstatic on behalf of the region at the New Zealand announcement.
The Pacific Islands Forum welcomes New Zealand's climate aid boost heading into COP26. Also,
some will be coming to the Bay of Plenty to assist with kiwifruit. There'll be others that will be going to the Hawke's Bay.
Relief in New Zealand as RSC workers start returning for the summer harvest. All that and more coming up on Tangata o Te Moana. Experts are warning that development gains across the Pacific region over the past 10 years could be undone due to the challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic. World Vision wants a once-in-a-lifetime multinational effort to rebuild Pacific livelihoods. Don Wiseman has more.
In the Pacific Aftershock report, World Vision reveals the results of a survey of households across the region. It says while much of the Pacific has not had local cases of COVID-19, there's been a tragic human cost due to the economic fallout. World Vision New Zealand's TJ Grant said the economic devastation could take a greater toll than the virus itself. Mr. Grant said while many Pacific nations managed to keep infections and transmissions at bay, vulnerable people are now facing the huge cost of closed borders and isolation.
Almost two-thirds of households have either lost jobs or lost incomes and had to resort to other alternative sources of income. Related to that, one in five households is having skip meals or eat cheaper meals because they can't afford to have a healthy diet. One of the compounding factors here is that through the COVID pandemic, food prices have rose significantly in many Pacific countries.
One of the nations worst hit by the economic turndown caused by the pandemic is Vanuatu. World Vision's country director in Vanuatu, Kendra Desaro, says Vanuatu has managed to keep COVID out, yet its food prices have soared by 30.6%. She says this puts healthy food out of reach for countless urban Ni Vanuatu.
Vanuatu is quite dependent on imports, particularly for urban households that work and cannot spend their time doing agricultural gardening and securing fresh food. Also, the prices of transport have gone up significantly because the importation of petrol has slowed down.
World Vision wants Australia and New Zealand to lead a once-in-a-generation step-up to help these developing nations overcome the devastating impacts of COVID. It's looking for a comprehensive international program of support for economic recovery to address key economic, health and child welfare issues. TJ Grant says stunted growth as a result of poor nutrition is a perennial Pacific problem and an occurrence like the virus and its aftershocks exacerbated. Kendra Desaro says New Zealand and Australia and other donor nations cannot abandon the Pacific when they need us most.
The COVID-19 pandemic is a global phenomenon as well as climate change, and we know that the Pacific Island nations are extraordinarily affected by climate change, even more so than other regions of the world. And so a regional crisis like this requires a regional response.
Roland Raja is a development economist with Australian think tank the Lowy Institute. He's written the Pacific will be economically put back 10 years by the pandemic. Mr. Raja told RNZ Pacific it's definitely amongst the worst affected by the lockdowns.
Already other parts of the world, you know, whether you look at Southeast Asia, even Sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America, the Caribbean, they're all on the rebound already, and their prospects for recovery are much stronger than it is for the Pacific. And there's a variety of reasons for that. It's fair to say that amongst the worst affected anywhere in the world.
Roland Raja says the Pacific nations typically can't follow the path of the developed nations and provide stimulus packages because they don't have the funds. But he suggests properly targeted infrastructure investment that is also aimed at addressing climate change, assisted by the metropolitan powers, may go some way to providing employment and income boosts.
The head of the Pacific Islands Forum says New Zealand's climate aid boost augurs well heading into COP26. The country is committing $1.3 billion over 4 years to support countries most vulnerable to climate change. Over half of the money is to go to the Pacific. Johnny Blades reports.
It's described by Climate Change Minister James Shaw as finance that is necessary to support some of the most vulnerable countries to adapt to the effects of climate change. New Zealand committed to this as part of signing up to the Paris Climate Agreement back in 2015. With the announcement coming ahead of the UN's climate change conference in Glasgow at the end of this month, Mr. Shaw hopes the boost will help repair some of the frayed consensus around the Paris Agreement.
Because the fact is that the developed world has not delivered on that commitment to collectively mobilise $100 billion a year. And that has led to a suspicion and a breakdown in relationships between the wealthier countries of the world, of which New Zealand is one.
The Pacific Islands Forum's Secretary General Henry Puna is heartened by the new level of support.
Absolutely ecstatic. I'm totally ecstatic on behalf of the region at the New Zealand announcement, and yet at the same time urge an ambitious climate action. And finance are the two hinges that are keeping the window open on a net zero 1.5 degree future, but time is running out.
He says he's hopeful all developed countries will finally fulfil the funding commitments they made in Paris, but which they've largely failed to meet.
And I think the US has already set the tone, and the announcement, although not on the same issue by China, that they're also coming to the party, I think augurs well for COP26. But we're certainly going there with full determination to try and talk to developed countries, you know, to support the commitments that were already made in 2015 in Paris.
Mr. Shaw says the funding will be on top of the existing aid program to the Pacific. And he says New Zealand will be guided by Pacific Islands governments on where the climate aid should be directed.
Last year, the Fijian Prime Minister asked our government for help as it undertakes the massive task of moving 42 villages further inland, away from rising waves. Many villages in low-lying countries like Tuvalu, Tokelau and Kiribati have no further inland that they can go. They must adapt to the dramatic changes that are already upon them.
But Dr. Luke Harrington, a senior research fellow at the New Zealand Climate Change Research Institute, says in terms of the country's overseas aid contributions, the boost is not enough.
All OECD countries have a target of about 0.7% of our gross national income. New Zealand sort of sits at the moment at about 0.27%. So that's about an annual shortfall of $1.2 billion. So the new money that's been announced today is on the order of about $250 million each year.
However, James Shaw says the funding boost can make a real difference.
The Cook Islands estimate that 25% of their annual budget is spent on climate-related costs, whether that's cleaning up after the last cyclone or trying to build stronger and better infrastructure and housing to resist the next cyclone.
But the minister concedes that the new climate aid level is no substitute for significant reductions to carbon emissions, and that on this front, few countries have done what is required.
RSE workers from Vanuatu, Samoa and Tonga will bring much-needed relief to New Zealand's horticulture and viticulture industries. Close to 400 Ngāi Vanuatu have arrived in Aotearoa ready for the fruit-picking season to join those who stayed behind during the pandemic. Alicia Foon has more about the measures being taken to keep workers COVID-free.
The floodgates have opened for New Zealand's one-way travel bubble for RSE workers, with at least 290 Ngāi Vanuatu already out of quarantine and straight to the production line. They've been joined by 150 more workers from Samoa, with a Tongan contingent expected within upcoming weeks. New Zealand Ethical Employers Chairperson Tania Porfare says it's a huge win to have RSE workers back on deck.
The workers are excited and raring to go, and the employers are really happy to see their extended family members back, their workers back, with a lot of smiles.
Last month, the government announced the commencement of one-way quarantine-free travel for RSE workers from Tonga, Vanuatu and Samoa. It was well received across the board, as it not only helps New Zealand's horticulture and viticulture industry, but is a major lifeline for Pacific RSE workers. Ray Wanemut has spent 8 seasons working on a vineyard in Blenheim and travels back to Vanuatu once a year to see his family.
Being away from the family is one of the most challenging things that the boys face. Like we think of our wives and our kids back home, but the other thing that we have to be strong about is making money to help them back home through this pandemic. I've got 3 kids, two sons of 10 and 4, and my daughter is 7 months. She was born when I left, so I haven't seen her. So I won't be seeing her until her first birthday, so I'm really hoping to go home. But like I said, things are tough. Have to be here to do stuff and help them back home.
He's a team leader on site and is shepherding the new arrivals from Vanuatu in the coming months. Instead of 2 weeks quarantine in MIQ, the new arrivals only have to complete 5 days isolation at their places of work. Tanya says at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine is required before travelling to New Zealand.
There's very specific things you can and can't do. Templates, there's forms, there's checklists, there's Ministry of Health guidance around each part of the living environment, the travelling environment and that work environment.
Seasonal Solutions is one of the first businesses to get involved in the RSE scheme. Its Chief Executive Helen Axby says they've been employing RSE workers for 13 years.
Between now and the end of the year, we'll have about 250 coming to the cooperative in the South Island. They work in Central Otago, and some will go to Canterbury and some to Marlborough for vineyard work. So we look after growers who are members of the cooperative in all those three regions. But we're working very, very hard to make sure that the quarantine-free travel arrangements work and that everybody's safe, communities are protected. We have 100% vaccination rates for our RSE staff.
She says there'll also be a new group coming from managed isolation from the Solomon Islands who are not part of the government's quarantine exemption. New Zealand Kiwifruit Growers Incorporated Chief Executive Colin Bond says RSE workers are an asset to New Zealand.
Some will be coming to the Bay of Plenty to assist with kiwifruit. There'll be others that will be going to the Hawke's Bay for apple work, Marlborough for some work in horticulture and viticulture, and potentially some down to Central Otago as well to help out with summer fruit season. It's a sign of relief that we have our RSE workers coming back into the country.
The Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment have confirmed future flights from both Samoa and Tonga are likely to happen before Christmas.
It's been a colourful New Air Language Week here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, despite various COVID-19 alert level lockdowns. The Auckland War Memorial Museum pulled out all the stops with its online offerings this week, including a host of New Air experts discussing topics ranging from music to activism. There are photo galleries and lots of interesting facts about New Airs, their language, culture and even their homeland, the Rock of Polynesia. With me from the museum is Olivia Tauma. Whakalofa lahi atu. I'll let you introduce yourself properly.
Whakalofa lahi atu ki e motolu o te Happy Noaean Language Week for the 17th to the 23rd of October. Ko Olivia Tauma e hingoa haku, the Te Oliva Pacific Strategic Manager at Tamaki Paingahira, Auckland War Memorial Museum. And I'm so excited to be with you here today. For Noaean Language Week, we have the theme Kia tupu ola ola e maui he tangata Niue. May the people of Niue thrive. This reminds us of the importance of our Pacific language and cultures and how they contribute spiritually, emotionally, mentally, physically and socially to our wellness and being at home, work, in the community and as a nation. And as a person living in Okalani, we need this even more at this time to keep us going. And I know that you will really enjoy a lot of our Niuean stories and our Niuean photos and collections that we are sharing with you this week.
Now, obviously, COVID has interrupted all of our language weeks for, I think, 2 years running now. It's been disrupting language weeks. But you're still doing some amazing stuff. I see online heaps of good stuff to keep people connected and involved, getting involved in Niue Language Week.
Yes, at the museum we have a commitment to our Pacific Tonga. We have a significant collection of our Pacific Tonga here that is the biggest in the Southern Hemisphere, and New Air plays a big part in this. We have an incredible interview with Tingi Lau Ness. If you've heard of Polynesian Panthers, if you have heard of Dawn Raids, then you will know who Tingi Lau Ness is, and you'll also know of his music through Herbs and the other incredible things that he does. And he talks about his support of the resurgence of Niuean language and culture in Aotearoa. We also have on the other end a personal blog by a very young Tautai Pacific intern who is with us at the museum, Paulina Bentley, and how she found it hard to connect with collections and displays in museums until she found a photo of a Niuean woman weaving, and she realized this is her grandmother. And that personal connection is what she talks about in her personal blog. And she also shares some of the weaving from our collections that she found of significance and connection to her family, which is really beautiful to hear from a young person in this space. We also have an interview with songwriter and choreographer Bulaleki Jackson Burke. And Leki has done a lot for Niuean youth and dance and encouraging our youth to learn about the Pacific culture and language through music and dance, and has shared a song with lyrics in both English and Niuean. And I think it's really important to hear from our young people as well in this space. As we know, Niue has more Niueans living here than in Niue. And so it's great to see a lot of people really advocating and pushing for our young people to learn the language and culture and be proud.
Awesome. I'll get you to give some directions to listeners on where and what's the easiest way to get to some of this great content.
So if you jump on the Auckland Museum website and you type in Pacific Language Weeks, I'll share the blog, the link on with Radio New Zealand here. You click the link and it'll take you to Niuean Language Week. And there is personal stories. There's also an interview with a Niuean language expert. And there's gallery of photos. We've got these photos from 1960s in Niue by Harry Coleman. And we put these up. We put 10 of them up last year, and they were very popular because what we're asking people is to have a look at them and see if they recognize anybody or recognize what the event is for. As part of our collections, we are trying to name a lot of people that we have in photos. And this information is very important for our people.
The president of the Federated States of Micronesia says geopolitical competition in the Pacific is not as fraught as international media often makes it out to be. David Panuelo also says Australia's recent nuclear submarine deal with the US and the UK is not a seismic shift in the international order. The president granted an interview to Johnny Blades, who joins me now. Johnny, what is the president saying?
Well, David Panuelo was commenting on the reported build-up of tensions, basically, between China and the US and also their competition for influence in the Pacific. He is challenging the notion that armed conflict is inevitable between these two powers and believes that all the sort of external powers of the region, so that also includes Japan, Australia and others, that they are just asserting their national interests, their economic interests. You know, and interestingly, regarding the recent nuclear submarine deal, the AUKUS pact, President Panuelo says there's nothing new about that alliance. And the biggest news from that, he says, is simply that there's another acronym at large, while regional security, he says, is actually strengthened from the deal as Australia gets access to newer technology. I mean, that probably doesn't quell concerns by many Pacific Island countries about nuclear elements, you know, or the interoperability of nuclear-powered submarines. But, you know, President Panuelo is sort of saying things aren't the heated knife fight that the international media sometimes make it out to be.
The Federated States of Micronesia, it's a tiny country. What influence does it have in the region?
Well, its influence is limited. I mean, yes, it is a small country in terms of land mass, something like 700 square kilometres. But in total territory, its waters span 260,000 square kilometres. And, you know, Micronesia is placed in this key strategic region in the Western Pacific. So north of Papua New Guinea and east of the Philippines. So quite close, really, to the region where tensions are up. South China Sea and all that. And I guess there's proximity to vital shipping lanes and the big fisheries. The other thing is the Federated States of Micronesia has relations with both US and China unlike most of the other independent Micronesian countries who recognise Taiwan. So Panuelo and his government are in a position to talk to both sides, to talk to these governments, and he says Micronesia has total faith and confidence in all parties to keep the Pacific region safe.
Now, the president recently had talks with U.S. defense chiefs in Hawaii, and this hasn't gone unnoticed.
No, that was misconstrued, President Panuelo says, misconstrued by media into headlines that the Federated States of Micronesia is set to allow one of its islands to become a U.S. military base. Instead, he says, no, the outcome of the talks was really about boosting U.S. Coast Guard help with tackling illegal fishing in Micronesia and for other things such as surveillance, search and rescue. Panuelo says all this talk of conflict, all this sort of speculation by the media distracts from the big issue, climate change. And he says the U.S., China, Japan, Australia, and other countries need to make climate change a separate, distinct, non-political matter for cooperation. And I guess on that front, the president and the other Micronesian and Pacific countries are anticipating that some big commitments must be made by the global community in just over a week or so at COP26 in Glasgow.
Vinaka Joni, now a full transcript of the questions and answers in the interview with David Panuelo is available on our website, rnzi.com. The airport for Tonga's main tourism hub in Vava'u could be massively expanded under the biggest ever infrastructure development seen in the country. The construction company Romana has revealed plans for a lengthening of the runway at Vava'u Airport, a new terminal along with solar and wind power systems to run it all. The planned runway extension would allow direct flights from the United States, the UAE, Japan and China. The company claims to have the backing of King Tupou VI, but no details have yet been revealed about who is paying for the development. The aim is to bring overseas tourists direct to the parts of Tonga that most want to visit and to facilitate the export of agricultural and marine products. Don Wiseman asked our Tonga correspondent, Kalafi Mwala, about the planned project and began by asking about the current state of Lupepau Airport in Vava'u.
They have the airport, the Lupepau Airport. The runway is 1,700 metres. And this proposal for the new airport will add on another 1,000 metres, maybe 2,700 metres altogether, the length of the runway, which means it'll be bigger than the runway here at Fuamotu.
A substantial runway, bigger than Wellington, significantly bigger than Wellington.
Okay, yeah. Yes.
So they definitely could take big planes. Who's going to pay for it?
That's a very good question, because there's no way the government of Tonga can pay for it. So they are totally dependent on foreign investments. And this company called Roa Mana has come up apparently with the investors saying, you know, they're going to not only supervise the project, but they are going to finance it, and they have the investors to do so.
These investors are from where?
Well, the company is registered in the UK, and it's touted to be an international company. So I don't know where the investors are going to come from. Very interesting situation. The three people that head up the company, they're Tongan nationals, and the guy who heads Javier Gatti, he's apparently a civil engineer and has been involved in international development. I don't know of any projects that they have presented as being something that they have done before. The interesting part about this company also, Don, is that it's only been registered in the UK for a year. So the company is only 1 year old, that's Romana. There are no projects anywhere that they can say, well, we did this development.
They are touting that they've got the backing of the king.
Yes, well, the king owns the land where the airport is going to be. And so they had to have approvals for them to come in. Their proposal has to be approved by the government, because the government owns the airport and has the ministries that operate anything to do with airports, Ministry of Transportation and so on. So they have to have government approval. And then because the king owns the land, they have to also have approval from the king for what they're going to have on the land.
Okay, so as well as the runway development, there's a lot else happening, isn't there?
So they're going to build the next major expenses is the new terminal. And so the two main expenses are the runway and the terminal. But there's going to be a lot of other things. The story that I have gotten from inside the company is the fact that there were two five-star hotels. They did name those hotels. They wanted to build in Lavau, facilitate the tourism flow into Lavau. And one of the requirements that those two hotels had was that they will not commit themselves to be in Lavau unless there is a big international airport where flights can fly in from anywhere in the world, any size of plane, to be able to land at that airport.
We don't know who it is that's proposing these hotels.
No. Although there have been conversations, Don, about Sheraton hotels being approached. There's a hotel chain out of Fiji that run the Tanoa hotels chain that they have been approached. There have been conversations like that, but there is nothing solid that I know of.
Well, we're talking about a very large amount of money, it would seem. It's a very grand scheme and perhaps the biggest ever infrastructure development in Tonga. What are their chances of getting it off the ground?
Well, the situation is that the government, I believe, is seeing this as an opportunity to have a project that they have had a vision or at least aspirations to see done. It's $121 million, translated into about 300 million Tongan paanga, just for the airport project alone. And that's a lot of money. And I understand that from New Zealand, that there's been a number of New Zealand companies that have been contacted and even co-opted to be involved in energy development, alternative energy, and all of those things. So you're looking at a number of participations from developing partners on this project. It looks, on paper at least, it looks good to go ahead. And it's not constructing a whole new airport as much as just using the same location, the same facility, and just expanding it to become Tonga's biggest airport.
Otago Polyfest in New Zealand happened online this week for the first time in its 28-year history. The festival director was determined not to let COVID-19 cancel the colourful celebration of Pacific culture, arts and dance. This week, more than 60 schools performed on stage for online broadcast under strict Level 2 conditions at Dunedin's Edgar Centre. Alicia Foom has more.
What up, whānau? Kia ora, kia ora, nā mālo lelei, nisam bula vinaka, whakalofolahi atu. Anio ngā se iu, guten tag. Welcome, no mai haere mai everybody to Otago Polyfest 2021, our live stream, people!
That's Ronnie Taulofo, Otago Polyfest MC, welcoming the celebration of Pacific culture, an event which connects young people with their heritage. But this year looks very different. In pandemic fashion, for the first time in 28 years, there is no audience and no school mingling, as the event is running under Alert Level 2 conditions, while New Zealand battles its community outbreak of the pandemic.
Absolutely zero audiences, I know. We're keeping this kind of COVID cash, but we're also, of course, we're adhering to Auntie Ardern's concerns and keeping everybody safe.
Polyfest director Tanya Mangototea says normally they'd have about 150 schools perform, but now it's just over 60.
Our people, Pacific Māori, uniting in a way that we know how. We're still providing a platform for cultural performance because that's our passion and that's our love. Yeah, it's heartbreaking because we've been, you know, we've all been in lockdown and we know how fortunate we are to be able to continue.
There's a huge stage and the Edgar Event Centre in Dunedin looks like a TV set with cameras broadcasting live to the Otago Polyfest Facebook page. Performers stretch from preschool to high school age, and there are even mums with babies performing. Tanya says schools have travelled from all around the Otago region, including Oamaru, Kaitangata and Dunedin.
You know, we're in the South Island, we're at the bottom of the South Island, and we've got one of the oldest polyfests, and so we've got a lead. So we have to be brave and do that, and we applaud the schools that have taken that leap, who have said, yeah, we want to come down, even though it feels like we're not together. We've tried our best to represent that online.
They've hit 50,000 views online, and the exposure is worldwide, with friends and family across the globe tuning in. Co-chair of Otago Polyfest, Angelina Chiore, says although it's been a big change not having crowds of thousands cheering performers on, they've had to learn how to adapt.
We made the commitment to continue in this COVID plan environment because we're committed to our young people and their ability to project their Māori and Pacific heritage to the world. And we are really grateful that early childhood centres and schools have looked at their own COVID plans and they've adjusted to move with us. So it's been an exciting but intrepid journey for us, working alongside some fantastic production team to be able to advise us on how we were going to do this safely for our young people.
Friendly Islands playgroup teacher Lavinita Tahafe travelled from Oamaru with 11 preschoolers to perform Tongan items of song and dance.
It's so amazing and they love to perform, even though some of them are just running around, but they know that the atmosphere is different and we enjoy it. Continue on doing it last 2 years and this year too. When we come here to New Zealand, most of our kids, they talk in English and they've got all our language, our mother tongue. And if we want to stick onto our culture, we just teach the kids to grow up and remember our home country.
She says Polyfest is one of the best ways Pacific children living in Aotearoa can connect with their identity.
That's Tangata o Te Moana for this week. Remember, you can download us free to your device from Spotify, iHeart or Apple Podcasts. Mutualukia.